Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome back, Simon Mundy here. This episode is all about how to stop struggling in life, to skillfully become more comfortable being uncomfortable and find more ease and innate resilience in the process. My guest is Jenna Ashford, the former elite hockey player turned psychologist and performance coach. Jenna's work is based on acceptance and commitment therapy, which I'm a big fan of, but she's a hardcore meditator too, having been on a 10-day Vipassana retreat. And we do talk about embracing being and finding peace there rather than just perpetual doing in the second half of this conversation, which I'm releasing tomorrow. There is so much good and valuable and powerful stuff in this conversation throughout the entirety of it. And if you put some of what Jenna talks about into practice, I can assure you it can be utterly transformative. Morning, Jenna. How lovely to see you. How are you?
Morning, Simon. I am all good, thank you. A little bit of a cold, but otherwise all good.
Well, there's a lot of it about. It's not easy when you've got a baby as well, which you have.
I do, exactly. They bring home all sorts of terms to delightfully pass on to you.
Just quickly, so you've got an 8-month-old, right? Because we've got a 9-month-old.
Yeah.
It's intense, isn't it?
So, I know, it is. It's amazing.
It is amazing.
It's sort of everything that you hope it to be and more, but also as hard as people say it is. So all of
it. Yes, absolutely. And perhaps we can come back to that a little bit, because I do think it's interesting relating to perhaps the doing the being question that we will touch on later in our conversation. But first, let's talk about what you do, what you're up to. So you are a psychologist, a sports psychologist and performance consultant these days, working in elite sport, business and education, correct?
Exactly. That's a pretty good summary.
I read on, I think it was Psychology Today, you said you have an in-depth understanding of how the mind works, which I thought was an excellent sentence. So in a nutshell, how does the mind work?
Wow, what a question to start us with. Do you know what? In a way, all our minds work in really similar ways. And in a way, we're all so different and unique. And that's what I love about what I do is psychology, that you have to just work with the person who you're talking to and who's in front of you. And you see the same patterns, and there's lots of stuff that comes up. We know we've got this part of our mind, I'm sure we'll talk about it, which loves to focus on the negatives and loves to assume the worst case scenario and all of that. And we all have that, even though sometimes it feels like we're the only one that does. But equally, like, what works for people in terms of moving on and managing some of that stuff is really different. So I just love getting to understand the sort of, the intricacies of the mind and what works for people. And only really they know. And so I see my job is helping them to sort of get rid of all the cloud that's covering the way and just help them figure out their own way of working.
That's a lovely approach. Just quickly, how would you actually define the mind?
Yeah, very good question. So I think there's two parts to it. I think there's a mind that does all of our wonderful thinking, that's pretty much on go all the time. And then I think there's a part of our mind that doesn't think and just sees and just observes and just notices. It's this unbelievable, when you sort of think about it, you know, what is it that's watching your thinking? What is it that can notice your thoughts? That's the part of our mind that we all have. We very rarely are aware of it or tap into it or access it, you know, in our sort of day to day. But it's just a part of us that is quiet and just sees.
Yes.
And I think the more that we can be aware of that and use it, then the less kind of pain and suffering we get into. So
absolutely.
Yeah, I think that there's those two great parts of it, and we need both. But perhaps we need our thinking mind a little bit less than we think we do.
Yes. The silent watcher, as Eckhart Tolle would call it.
Yes.
And yes, we'll come to that again in a second, but let's talk a little bit about your backstory, because you were an elite hockey player. You were captain of your school, captain of the county, first England cap at 15, a prodigy, I would say. You won the Premier League 7 times. And yet, there is this story that you outline in your fantastic book, Drop the Struggle, that you never quite made it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you're growing up, and I grew up in a competitive, sporty family, and various of my other siblings represented England at various different sports. And I think, you know, particularly in a sport like hockey, where the Olympics is the pinnacle, that's the dream, that's the goal. And anything short of that is kind of failure. And that's what I had in my mind, you know, until pretty recently, that actually, if you didn't make it to Olympics, then you sort of didn't really make it. And it's only in recent years when I sort of look back and reflect and think about not only like, yeah, great, the competitions or the medals in hockey, but more importantly, the journey, the experiences, the people, and the opportunity it gave me to figure out who I am and, all of that great stuff. So yes, I think I had lived with the story for a long time if I never quite made it. And I think now I'm really comfortable with what hockey gave me and the experiences I had. And I'm really proud of that.
Does the story ever still pop up?
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. Especially when, you know, I'm in a context where I'm having to step into a space of being, you know, a former elite hockey player, or, you know, I tentatively use that term because, you know, I didn't go to the Olympics. So technically, can you only use that term if you went, you know, if you're an Olympian? Or so, yeah, I definitely do still have that. I have to sort of remind myself that it's not always about the Olympics or the medal.
Yeah. So it's not about getting rid of the story, it's about your relationship with that story as well, which is fundamental. And we can talk about that. But you spoke as well as about losing a bit of your passion for the sport and sense of purpose as you went on, which I thought was interesting. Why do you think that was, and when did that come about?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I think, to be really successful in your sport, and okay, what is success? You know, we can use that term loosely, but you have to dedicate, you know, you have to dedicate a lot to it. There's no doubt about it. And my personality is one in which I love variety. I love just doing lots of different stuff. I love all sports. I love travel. I love things like skiing, which you could never do when you were sort of playing, you know, elite hockey. And I think I just got to a point where I was dedicating so much of my life to it, and I saw what I was missing out on, and I kind of resented that.
Gotcha.
And for some people, it's definitely worth it to stick with your sport and your passion and go for your goal. And for me, it just got to a point where I just kind of lost the love for it, because I was just doing that one thing so much, and I just kind of wanted to do other things. And it was really hard that time of, I know I could be good enough to do this if I really buckled down and, you know, put the work in, but also I see another path in my life that I think I probably want to take instead. And I think it takes, you know, not getting selected to answer those questions. You know, okay, I haven't been selected. It got to about sort of 2021, where you make the jump from junior England to the seniors. And it's at that point where you think, right, do I want to step up a gear now or do I want to go on to other things? And I think just for me and my personality, like what I value, we might talk about values, but what I value is that kind of adventure and variety. So, yeah, it was at that point I took a different path.
That's interesting because a lot of people talk about fulfilling your potential and it's mm-hmm. seen in such a narrow way, isn't it? Of, oh, someone hasn't fulfilled their potential in this sport, but actually you're missing out on so much and you just don't know. As you say, for you, like there was much more about life that was important to you. So actually this kind of narrative of fulfilling your potential within a sport, you can't say that definitively. Someone might have that myopic focus that enables them to give absolutely everything, but that doesn't mean that they're fulfilling their potential more than someone who wants to experience some of the other rich elements of life, friendship, laughter, travel, love, all those things. And I talk about that in my book and try and sort of explain you can't define potential so narrowly.
It is so true. It's so true. And it's really interesting now in my work as a sports psychologist, you know, my job is to help people perform as well as they can and to achieve their goals. And that was always the role of a sports psychologist. And I think more and more now there's the recognition that, yes, but they also have to be a happy, content, fulfilled person whilst they're doing it. And so you have this interesting dynamic where what if the pursuit of highest performance in your sport makes you miserable? You know, then what do I do as a sports psychologist? And I think, of course, well, not for everyone, but for my philosophy is the person first and, cool. you know, figuring out what's important to them in their life and supporting them with that rather than just the sport.
Absolutely. It's got to be person first, right? Like, what's the point if you're not happy, content, fulfilled? Like, what is the point if you're not enjoying it?
Yeah, and it sounds so easy when we talk about it, but equally people get so wrapped up in sport, like rightly so, because it is.
And business, right? And important. All these other things, these other
of
high
course.
Performance.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for in that moment, in your that sort of snapshot of your life, that is the most important thing. And it's really hard to zoom out and see the bigger perspective sometimes.
Quick one on high performers then across the board, whether it be elite sport or, you know, CEOs of big companies or whatever it may be. In my experience, having spoken to a lot of people who do those kind of things, not always by any stretch, so I'm not saying this is across the board, but in a lot of cases, it does come from a sense of perhaps internal disquiet. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that to some degree?
I do agree. I absolutely do agree. And that's where I think there has to be some kind of healthy balance where, you know, if you're using sport to manage your internal disquiet, that is not a bad outlet. That is much better than drugs or, you know, doing criminal offences or whatever it is. It's clearly that's quite a positive outlet. But if you're using it to hide away from or escape from stuff that's going on internally, it will catch up with you, i.e. you'll get that medal and it will feel hollow, or you'll get to the end of your career where you're going to have to retire because your body says, I can't go on anymore, and it will be what next. So I think sport offers an amazing opportunity to, you know, perform, fulfill your potential, let's say, to perform at the highest ability you can. But alongside that, I think it offers an amazing opportunity to figure out and discover who you are and what's important to you.
I wrote a chapter in my book called We Not Me, which is all about the Rio 2016 squad. And you know a lot of them and you would have played alongside them. Mm. So was that tricky in any way, watching or being aware of the success that they had?
Yeah, so do you know what? I was there as well. I watched the final live in Rio. I went with my family to the Olympics because we've always loved sort of the Olympic spirit and going and watching. I would say that there was probably a part of me that was like, that's pretty cool. I would have loved to have been there. But I think probably at that point, I'd you know, made peace with the fact that I just, that was never going to be me. Well, it wasn't never going to be me. I chose for that not to be me. And I was okay with that. So I think probably a bit of both and.
Yeah, both and, like that. Mm. When did you then decide you wanted to really get into the inner world stuff?
So I think I studied psychology at uni. I was always really fascinated by it. And after uni, I kind of didn't really know what I wanted to do with that degree. So I went over to Germany to play a season out there. And whilst I was there, I worked for a sports marketing company. And I was effectively selling those LED banners around the edge of a football pitch, like selling the marketing places for those. And it was really cool. And I loved it. It was a great team. And I remember just thinking, like, what is this doing? Who am I helping here? And yeah. I realized in that job that I really wanted to help people. That was, you know, something that was gonna fulfill me and that I really wanted to do. So I came back to UK and studied a master's in sports psych, and then that gave, you know, combining my two passions of sport and psychology, it was like the absolute dream job. And I think just, yeah, over the years of working with various people, it's just confirmed. Whenever people ask me now, would you recommend a career in sports psychology? I couldn't recommend it more highly. It's fascinating.
Let's talk about your book then. So your book is called Drop the Struggle. Fantastic. Really, really enjoyed it. As I said to you before we started recording, I'm quite familiar with a lot of the concepts and the ideas in it, because as you know, I'm really into ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, which is it's based on. Which was absolutely foundational for me and had such a transformative impact on my life. So I loved it. But what I found interesting was that it reminded me actually how deep you can go with certain aspects of it. And it was nice to have that reminder that to not be almost blasé about ACT and its effectiveness and how powerful it can be and the change that it can make in someone's life. So to kick things off, we've already touched on it, but I was delighted that when the first thing, or one of the first things, once I got past your story, was speaking about the difference between the thinking mind, and you call it the observing mind. I tend to call it the aware mind. And now this recognition, or having this pointed out to me, was, I often say, the most important thing, or one of the most important things that's ever happened in my life. Guy Meadows was the chap who introduced me to it. When he pointed out, oh, there's the thinking mind and then there's the aware mind or the observing mind, I would say that one sentence has reverberated ever since throughout my life and deepened in so many ways. So did it have a similar impact on you when it was brought to your attention?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I'm totally with you. It's just that recognition that you can step back from your thoughts, which just gives you an unbelievable amount of perspective, I guess, power as well, like not power to control, but just power to choose. You know, that great Viktor Frankl quote. But yeah, I think until you kind of sound a little bit crazy when you first start talking about it, and I'm always, you know, careful with how I introduce it to clients, because it does sound a bit like, okay, you've got two minds and one can watch the, you know, it's a strange concept. But once you get a head around it, it's just, yeah, absolute game changer.
In your experience, how familiar are people with it?
It depends, but I'd on the whole say not very. I think, it takes a bit of time. And, you know, all you have to do is sit there for 10, 20 seconds and just go through that practice of like watching your thoughts.
Yeah.
And then once you've had an experience of that, it's like, okay, I think I get it. And then it's just thinking about how you can apply that in kind of day-to-day experiences. But yeah, I think on the whole, I suppose people in deep down, they know it somewhere, but they've never kind of come across it or verbalized it or stopped to think about it.
Yeah, it's becoming aware of the fact that you are aware, essentially, that there is this background presence that is so easy to overlook, yet is the most fundamental thing about us, really. So how do you then get people to recognize this observing mind?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the great thing about ACT, one of the things I love about it is it's really kind of practical, and there's loads of activities and there's loads of metaphors that help people to connect with the content, I suppose. So there's loads of ways you can do it. But I mean, simply, like I just said, getting people to watch their thoughts for a bit helps. You can use, there's a good metaphor about a camera filming a wildlife scene. So, you know, the wildlife scene is happening, the lion is chasing the antelope, and the camera is just filming it, and the camera's not judging the scene or wanting the lion to win or wanting the antelope to escape. It's just simply capturing it. So that's quite a nice metaphor for the observing mind, just capturing all of the content that's going round and round in your thinking mind.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So when you say watching your thoughts, would you get them just to sit still, not actively think, but just notice what comes up?
Exactly.
Just notice that it trundles along, it has its own momentum.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think like within session or, you know, within a conversation, there'll be various points where they've got an internal dialogue going alongside the conversation. And so just at various points saying, you know, what are you thinking now? What's going through your mind now? And then getting them to check back in with that. And they might be aware of it, but they might not be. So just that, you know, process of, okay, we're having a conversation, but you're also having thoughts in your mind. Let's just stop and see what's happening there. And some of them can be, you know, I'll play around with it, because some of it might be, what's this crazy lady talking about? Or, you know, where are we going with this? Or, you know, so just getting them to see in this snapshot, in this moment here, what's happening in your mind. And then, you know, that practice, that process of just checking in with your thoughts becomes then, you know, a fundamental part of being able to do something about it.
You spoke about thinking about this observing mind, which is kind of doesn't quite work in some ways, because you can't actually do that. Really, because you can't conceptualize it properly, can you? It's pretty tricky. How would you then encourage people to let it become more obvious? Because the first step obviously is just noticing there's something there that is observing or is aware of your thoughts and your feelings and your sensations and your perceptions. In my experience, the more you're aware of it, the more that you bring the observing to the observing mind, the more obvious it becomes. It goes from being invisible to increasingly obvious, and then like really starts to shine in your experience. So how would you nudge people along that way?
Yeah, and I think it's all just practice. It always amazes me how, you know, particularly in environments like sport or business, we spend a lot of time, you know, physically training, don't we, for sports. You know, getting our fitness ready, or in, you know, in business we'll prepare for meetings or whatever it is. And it's, you know, it's the same in psychology and with your mindset. It takes practice to you know, get good at this stuff, and that's where mindfulness is, you know, really helpful. But just taking those opportunities within a day to just notice your observing mind, and almost if you take away thought, that's what's left is that awareness, that observing mind. So it's almost not even doing anything, but just, you know, allowing the thoughts to kind of get out of the way, if you see what I mean. So I think, you know, and I'm a big fan of James Clear's work in Atomic Habits, but even just when you're brushing your teeth, using that as an opportunity to notice, or when you know, walk to your car in the morning, or walk to the bus stop, just finding opportunities within a day it doesn't have to be long or much just to check in with this process of noticing your thoughts. And the more that you can do it in a place where you're fairly relaxed or content, or, you know, nothing too stressful is going on, then come to those pressure moments when you kind of really need to be able to manage your mindset, then I think it becomes a lot easier.
Yes. And it is there before thoughts. And you've got a baby daughter?
Yes, daughter.
Same here. And their thinking minds, because they're a month apart, are not online yet. So this aware, observing consciousness, that's there now. And it's very obvious, isn't it, with babies? But then as we get older, we tend to lose touch with it. But it never goes anywhere. In fact, it can't go anywhere. Thoughts come and go, right? And feelings come and go. But this observing, aware presence is always there. It's always available. In fact, it's the one thing about the entirety of our experience, internal or external, that is constantly present.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, you've, I'm sure, heard the metaphor of the sky and the weather, right? So the sky, no matter what the weather is, even if you can't see the sky is there. It is always there. And the weather will come and go. And it's, you know, exactly the same with our thoughts. Our thoughts will come and go. Sometimes there'll be dark clouds, sometimes there'll be sunshine, but the sky is always there. And our capacity to step back and observe our thoughts is always there. It just sometimes is easier and harder to access depending on your state.
So this is the essence of ACT. And actually, it's the essence of much more than ACT as well. I mean, it's the essence of spirituality, actually, as well. And that's a bit of a loaded word. I mean, if you want to get people's eyebrows raised, then. Yeah. But it's pretty simple, really. It's this same recognition that there is this aware presence there first. So everything else in ACT sort of stems from this recognition, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So just being able to notice that you've got thoughts means that then you can take that step back and then you can apply some of these different skills in ACT that we talk about. But I think that, yeah, you can't really do the process of ACT without fundamentally appreciating that.
What I find interesting is that there is this recognition and then it can fan out into much more stuff, which we're about to dive into. And then it sort of folds back into this recognition as well. It's almost paradoxical. But let's talk about then, we'll start with, we'll go with how your book does it. So we'll talk about playing in the now. And you start with an Eckhart Tolle quote. I can't actually remember which one it is, but essentially it's be here now. That's not actually his, that's Ram Dass's, but fundamentally that's what he's on about. So can you just talk a little bit about playing in the now?
Yeah, so our book sort of fundamentally, I suppose, uses in ACT, there's a thing called the Hexaflex, which kind of describes the various processes. And we try and take it in Drop the Struggle, we try and take the Hexaflex and make it a bit more, I suppose, linked to sport, but also the language we use is a bit kind of, I suppose, less theoretical. So playing in the now is about recognizing that our mind, our thinking mind, has a wonderful capacity to dwell on the past, to worry about all the things that have gone before, and also a great ability to think or worry about the future. And it's not very good at staying in the here and now. And I think it would be fascinating to analyze the different thoughts you have in a day and see, you know, how many of them are past, present, and future focused. But playing in the now is essentially just recognizing that our mind's really good at the past and the future. And noticing there's nothing wrong with being in the past or being in the future if that's what we're choosing to do. So obviously, if we want to reflect on something that's happened that day, think about it, think about what could have gone better, great. If you want to plan for the future, obviously that's a necessary skill. But I think we get dragged into it, you know, sort of without consciously doing it. So playing in the now is just about recognizing when we're doing that, and importantly, when it's unhelpful. So unhelpful for us in terms of our performance, or unhelpful for us in terms of just our sort of general contentment. And then being able to bring ourselves back to the present. And that's where you need to use that observing mind to notice that your thoughts have gone unhelpfully into the past or the future. And then have a skill or something to help bring you back to the here and now. Knowing that, of course, your mind will then wander again into the past and the future. and having something to help bring you back to the present. And it's just that ability to do that flexibly when you want to, when you need to.
And that psychological time travel, when we do worry about the future, we can't do anything about it because the future only exists as a thought in the mind. Mm-hmm. And it can become quite catastrophic in my experience. You know, you can get pretty worried about stuff. And yet, invariably, when the thing we're worried about arrives into the now, we're far better equipped to deal with it. And it tends not to be as bad as we imagine it's going to be.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. You know, we're very good at assuming the worst case scenario. And actually, you know, it very rarely happens. There's a really nice video I've seen on YouTube that says, are you worried about something in the future? And then it says, is this something within your control? And if the answer is yes, then it says, well, then why worry? And then it says, is this something out of your control? If the answer is yes, then why worry? So it's kind of like, regardless of whether you can do something about it or you can't, like, why are we worrying about it? Mm. So yeah, but it's a mind pattern that our minds get into. It's a habit pattern, and it's the important thing is being aware of it, so that you can then break it. And it's not easy to break that habit pattern, but the more aware of it you are, that's got to be the starting point.
You talk about some useful techniques or practices to root yourself in the now, because the now actually, almost without exception, or without exception, is bearable. It's always bearable. But our thoughts about the future don't have that similar safety aspect to them. So just in terms of a couple of the things you mentioned in the book, you talk about 1 minute focus, mindful breathing, of course. Djokovic, big fan of that. And we can talk a little bit about him, actually, because I want to talk about him and Ons Jabeur. And then flex your attention. So could you just touch, let's start with 1 minute focus and flex your attention. So taking it to the sensations on your foot, for example.
Yeah. So I think, 1 minute focus is just about providing that opportunity to practice this and to recognize that, you know, for a period of time, and you can set yourself a timer or whatever it is, but just to practice the ability of, okay, I'm in this minute, I'm going to watch my thoughts, and I'm going to watch when they go off on a tangent, and I'm going to bring them back. And just, you know, being able to do that. And it's not that in a minute your aim is to not think about anything. Like, we're recognizing that our minds are great thinking machines. It's just to be aware of that thought and to bring it back. And then I think it links with the flexibility thing, which is, they talk a lot about being flexible, and we try not to set rigid rules for how or when you should think, but it's all just about that ability to flex your attention when you want to and when you need to. So, being able to observe the sensation of your foot or underneath your foot. And if you just are doing that now, whether your foot's on the floor or in the air, you can observe that sensation. Unless we start with your left foot, and then you can move it to your right foot, and you can move it back to your left foot, and you can move it to your hand or your head, or you can do that. You can flex your attention. And it's the same in life more broadly. If we then zoom out to, you know, you're playing in a big match, and you've got a specific, if it's football and you've got a specific corner or a penalty or something that you've got to focus on, and then you do that, and then you've got to zoom back out and focus on the strategy and where people are on the pitch. So it's just that ability to recognize that we can go big, we can go small, we can focus on one thing, then we can move it to another. It's the practice of doing it, and then you realize, wow, okay, I do have an ability here to move my attention.
God knows how, but we do. Let's talk then about mindful breathing. So I was at Wimbledon last year working for BBC TV, and I do the in-depth interviews after matches. And I remember before the finals, I interviewed Novak Djokovic, who was in the men's final, and Ons Jabeur, who was in the women's final. And I remember Ons talking about positive thinking and changing a negative thought to a positive thought. And I did have some alarm bells going, thinking, oh no, this could go wrong. And I remember before the women's final, and she was favorite and she'd lost in the final the previous year as well. And I could see her in the behind the doors, ready to come out on centre court, and she looked tense. And I remember thinking that that's not a great sign. And so, and I think that's the thing with trying to change, for example, a negative thought into a positive thought, because if you're nervous, you're going to have that deluge of quote unquote negative thoughts. But if you're wrestling and trying to change all of them into positive, that takes up a lot of energy. And as it happened, she went out and definitely underperformed for her and produced the worst performance of the championships and lost in a shock. And then if I think of Novak Djokovic, and he was interviewed recently and someone said, oh, your greatest strength is your mental talent. And he said, let me stop you and correct you. It's not a talent. It's something I've worked on. And he highlighted in particular mindful breathing. He said, look, often there's a storm going on inside, a fear and anxiety and whatever, but it's about, you know, you get pulled away by this storm and then being able to refocus on the here and now. And he said, I don't like this idea that we should only be positive, that, you know, we're human beings, we're going to have this storm. And I thought that was really refreshing to hear. And I feel a bit for Ons Jabeur that actually perhaps she didn't have this way of looking at things, because it certainly would have equipped her better actually to deal with those nerves, in my opinion. So just speaking specifically then about mindful breathing.
Yeah, you had to feel for Ons, didn't you, in that match? And I mean, she has a mental coach with her. So she's obviously trying and working on it, which is, you know, I think a massive positive. But like you say, there's just something about, as much as we'd love to just think positive thoughts, you're about to step into a Wimbledon final, like you're going to have nerves. And the whole point of ACT is just to take the power out of those thoughts. So they're still there, but you're able to then play as, you know, your best tennis, even with those thoughts. And mindful breathing is, for me, I describe it as like a bit of an anchor. So you talked about the emotional storm. And if you imagine a ship out at sea in the middle of a storm, it's getting thrown around left, right and centre. And it's just totally chaotic and, you know, it's very unstable. And for me, when that boat throws down an anchor, it then has some element of stability. There's still a storm going on, but it's able to just remain a bit more stable in that storm. And that's what mindful breathing does. It just brings you back to that present moment, puts down that anchor. There might still be all sorts of thoughts going on, like, oh my goodness, it's a Wimbledon final. I don't know, Brad Pitt's in the crowd or David Beckham's in the crowd. Sometimes you get those big celebs. I don't know whether Djokovic, he probably doesn't even mind about those sort of things. But
And nor should he. You know, they're only people. No,
true. You know, whatever thoughts he's got going on, it's just then bringing himself back to that present moment. And when you're thinking about your breathing, you're not thinking about X, Y, and Z that might happen, right? So that's one benefit, is it just brings your thoughts back to the here and now.
Can I just challenge you? Not challenge you, but just stop you on that. You said thinking about your breathing, but isn't it more being aware of your breathing as opposed to thinking about it?
Yeah. So I think when you're, it's a really good question. When you're about to step onto a Wimbledon final, I think it's deliberately thinking about your breathing.
Okay.
Because it then channels your thoughts into something that's a present focus. You can be aware of your breath, but you're still thinking about your breath. And so when you think about mindful breathing, you're then bringing your thoughts to the here and now. And of course, your observing mind will be hopefully a part of that as well. But you're also it also has that massive positive impact on your physical self as well, in terms of relaxation and just, you know, managing the heart rate. So I think you can be aware of your breath, of course you can, but I think often what for me anyway, and look, everyone's got a different view on these things, I think it's deliberately thinking about your breathing in that moment just helps to manage that emotional storm.
That's interesting. So when you say thinking about your breathing, would you be, for example, like counting your breaths or saying in, out, or like how would you, would there be a bit of labeling going on? How would you think about your thoughts?
Yeah. So again, I think what works for you, but for example, you can just, so there's various spectrums, right? So firstly, we might just watch it. We might just watch our breath, which taps in more towards our observing mind. We might move to counting our breath, which then you're starting to use your thinking mind, right, to do that. You might try and control your breath. So do a 3 seconds in, hold it for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 3 seconds out. So there's various spectrums, I think, where you can use your breath all the way from just observing it to managing or controlling it in some way.
Interesting. I like that. Bit of a potentially deep question for you here. How would you define the difference between awareness and attention?
That's a good question. So I think our aware mind, as you call it, observing mind, as I call it, doesn't think. It is just aware. When you're paying attention to something, you could use the terms interchangeably, but another definition of attention would be directing your thoughts towards something.
Yeah.
So then you're using your thinking mind.
Because I would say it's like the aware mind is always there, always present, and covers everything. Like there isn't a part of our experience. We've obviously been focusing on thoughts, but there's also feelings, sensations, perceptions of what we perceive through 5 sense organs, and that makes up the entirety of our experience. And none of it could exist without the awareness already being there. So it's always there and it pervades everything. And then attention, I would say, is almost like a stretching out of that into one area. So I can look at on the shelf in front of me my eldest daughter's dance trophy. And I've got my attention on that dance trophy while simultaneously, out of the corner of my eye, being aware of the lamp over here that I'm not looking at. And, for example, the sound of my voice or the sensations on the soles of my feet. In fact, everything's brought in. Someone actually gave me quite a nice analogy. It's like attention is when a lion is feasting on a zebra, let's say, and he's focusing on that. That's the attention. But the awareness is what is aware of the landscape that he's on, to be conscious of other predators and that kind of thing. So it's like, for me, it's the awareness is the fundamental thing, and the attention stretches out from that awareness put on an object. Does that make sense?
Nice. Makes total sense. Yeah. And I get you. I think we're saying very similar things. It's just that, yeah, that I like the way you sort of, the action that you're doing, kind of drawing it out. I suppose you can, see it as like a spotlight in the theatre, isn't it?
Yes, spotlight. That's nice. Right, let's move on to Drop the Struggle. Why don't you tee this one up?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously the book's called Drop the Struggle as well, and I suppose that's because, fundamentally, I think once you've realised this whole awareness observing piece, you then have this opportunity to drop the struggle with those thoughts. And what I mean by that is, let's say Djokovic has the thoughts before he goes out into the Wimbledon final, I am terrified of losing this. I want to be, I want to go down in history. I don't want to lose this match. That would be a very normal thought for him to have. So you've got options here. He can either think, oh no, I need to be thinking positive. I don't want to be thinking those things. Mm. I'm going to try and distract myself. I'm going to put my headphones in, or I'm going to try and think of something else, or blah, blah, blah. Or he can go, well, that's all right. That's just my thinking mind. Of course it's going to think that.
Mm.
And then take that mindful breath, or use that awareness to redirect his attention, let's say, or just to simply allow that thought to be there. We don't have to do anything with it.
No, yeah.
And the difference in those two approaches is the difference, I think, in, let's say, Ons Jabeur versus Novak Djokovic's performances, which is, one is tense and fearing failure, and the other is open and curious and stepping into being the player that you want to be, rather than trying to not make a mistake. So dropping the struggle is not about not having thoughts. It's about whatever thoughts you have, just not fighting against them. Someone said to me once, just don't place importance on them.
Yeah,
I remember at the time I was thinking, yeah, what does that mean? But it's so true, isn't it? If they can be there, it's the fighting against them or the placing importance of them that then makes them bigger and stronger. If we just simply allow them to be there, then it becomes something that doesn't have to affect us.
Mm. Yeah, a thought is just a thought irrespective of its content.
Mm.
And that quote, what you resist persists, seems
totally
pretty salient for this as well. And you talk about the difference between fusion and diffusion. And I often talk about the diffusion technique, which helped me escape insomnia back in the day, because I was trying to escape the prison of my thinking with more thoughts, which is such a normal approach, I'm sure. I mean, it's that positive thinking, isn't it? That's one form of trying to escape thinking with more thinking. Then I was introduced to that diffusion technique and it made all the difference. So yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about fusion, diffusion, and that diffusion technique?
Yeah, which diffusion technique you talk about? There's lots.
So in the book, you talk about I'm having the thought that, and that was the one that most resonated with me back in the day. I've tweaked it slightly just to I'm aware of the thought that, because it then draws attention to the fact that there is this observing or aware mind, but it's basically the same thing.
So it's a bit essentially taking a thought, whatever thought you're having, and ahead of that, putting the sentence, I'm having the thought that. So let's say we go back to that thought of I'm having the thought that I'm terrified to lose this match. When you do that, and then you can then go one step further and you can say, I notice that I'm having the thought that I'm terrified to lose this match. And again, what it just does is it goes from a thought that's all consuming. You know, if you imagine holding your hands up to your face, right up close to your face, it's right there. It's, I can't do anything else because I'm just so focused on my hands being in front of my face. To actually, if you just put your hands down to the table or to the lap or, you know, wherever you're sat, they're still there, those thoughts, but they're just less all consuming. And so what that sentence tends to do for people is it takes the thought from something that is true and is real to something that is literally just, I mean, what even is a thought when we think about it? It's an image, or it's a memory, or it's something, you know, passing through our mind. I notice I'm having the thought that I'm terrified to lose this match becomes then, okay, well, it's literally just a thought, and it's one that will pass and another one will come. That's the idea of diffusion, is stepping back from it and unhooking from it or getting space from it. And there's lots of, you know, diffusion ones. There's quite fun ones in ACT, like singing the thought in a tune or saying it in a funny voice or in an accent or something, just as a way to just take that step back and to release that fusion with the thought.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Jenna Ashford. Jenna's work is based on acceptance and commitment therapy, which I'm a big fan of, but she's a hardcore meditator too, having been on a 10-day Vipassana retreat. And we do talk about embracing being and finding peace there rather than just perpetual doing in the second half of this conversation, which I'm releasing tomorrow. Please do keep your emails and messages coming. The best way is via my website, simonmundy.com. And if you would consider sharing this episode, I would be very grateful.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.